Blog Talk Radio.
Inner Healers is a worldwide community of people who believe healing comes from the inside, as well as all the answers needed to live a happy, healthy life. As such, has set the Inner Healers Radio, an online talk show on alternative medicine, to provide life guidance and help people connect their emotions with their natural inner state of health. With this radio, and the help of all our guests and callers, we hope to create a space for sharing our lights online. Listen to your favorite teachers, authors, psychologists, channelers, healers, psychics, music therapists, and more. Join show host, healer, and founder of Inner Healers in Peru, Susana Stiglitz, while she unravels each topic hand in hand with her wise guests. Many people around the world have improved their lives thanks to their sharing through the Inner Healers community. Join us for a joyful experience. Shows are recorded, so you can download each as a podcast to listen on your way to work or whenever needed.
Well, hello everybody. Welcome to our Inner Healers Radio. My name is Luciana Stiglitz and I will be your host for today. Our very special guest is Lynn Forrest. She's a non-traditional practitioner who through 23 years in faith work oriented to coming into the right relationship with very happy power and happy beliefs about self and the world are for few results at wounding. Help me welcome Lynn today. Hello, Lynn.
Hey, Luciana, it's good to be here.
Wanting to share your light with all of us.
Well, thank you. The broadcast is cutting a little bit in and out for me. It's cutting in and out a little bit, so I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Yeah, I guess we're having a Wi-Fi signal today, but I will try to speak as slowly as possible so that you can
understand. I appreciate that.
What I'm saying. Okay, so our topic for today is reparenting our wounded child towards peace.
Luciana, I don't know if you're able to hear me, but I cannot hear you at all. You're cutting in and out. So.
Mm-hmm. How about this? Can you listen to me here?
I can hear you a little. Yeah, I hear you real clearly for like a sentence, and then I lose you again.
Okay, I will open the chat in Facebook as well.
Okay, let me go there too. Yeah, it's cutting out again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm opening the chat also. Okay. Okay, so let's start talking about engineers. You were saying that I read something that you wrote about us being working on some roles by birth order. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm talking about the every family, there's a particular system of birth order that just simply by being born in a particular position, if you're number one child versus number two child, can actually, what comes with that birth position may be an actual set of rules or a script by which we will oftentimes live our life. It's as if the system has its own needs, just like an individual has a need. So the family, once a family is created, it has its own needs. And each child, the job of each child in the system is to fulfill a particular need. Like, for instance, the firstborn child, very often what the system most needs, especially if there's dysfunction between the parents, is they need a hero. They need a child who will bring them a sense of worth. If they're struggling with self-esteem, then this child, all of a sudden, the pressure is on for this child to be that which brings them a sense of worth. And the child will sort of like absorb that energy through osmosis. They begin to get a sense of, okay, I need to be responsible. I need to be the star. I need to be the one who brings attention, positive attention to the family. And so just by being born first child, that can be sort of the setup. Second-born children have a different role, and very often the need of the family, once they have the star, the child assigned to bring worth, now what they need is health. The system needs to feel like a healthy system. And the second-born child's role is very often that of what we call the scapegoat. Their job is to bring health. The way they bring health to a family system is by being the one who is the problem, so that everyone in the family sort of points their finger at the second-born child and says, if it weren't for that child, this would be a healthy family. And so second-born children very often feel the pressure. They pick up the message that there's something defective about them, that there's something wrong with them, that they're not good enough, that they're bad children, sort of the rotten apple in the bunch. And then the third child comes along, and this child, the family is so busy taking care of the firstborn hero child's needs, going to all of their star-winning performances, and cleaning up after the second-born child and trying to control their behavior, that by the time the third child comes along, what the system may need is just simple relief. So the role of the third-born child then becomes one of needing to be sort of the lost child, the one who has no needs, the one who sort of disappears. I often say that you can tell when a person grew up as a lost child in their family, because it'll be the person who you kind of go, well, where is Susan? I don't see Susan. And she'll be sitting right beside you. They are so good at withdrawing or into themselves, sort of pulling their energy in, that they even seem to disappear. And because the message to them is that their needs don't matter, that they aren't supposed to need anything. And then there's another role that very often, if there's a fourth-born child, the fourth-born child is very often their job for the family is to provide a sense of distraction. And that means that when tension is rising high between family members, maybe the parents are at it with each other or something, then it becomes the fourth-born child's job to distract as a way of pulling the energy away from the troubled situation and to themselves. Maybe they'll turn backflips down the hall, or they'll break out with some funny story, or they'll do some crazy thing. So fourth-born children often sort of get the leftovers. They are often followers, and it's like the old saying, craziness rolls downhill like a snowball. It just continues to gather momentum, and by the time the fourth-born child comes into the family, what lands in their lap is all the craziness of the system. So that's just a brief introduction to the four roles.
What about if the family has five or more children?
Very often, several things can happen here. Now, first thing I want to say is that this system that I'm describing to you is a blueprint. It's not carved in granite. It doesn't mean that everyone's family is going to follow suit. There can be particular circumstances that create deviation from this role. But very often, if there's a fifth child, in the natural order of things, that they'll start over, or they'll pick up the role that meets the need of the family most at that particular time, at the birth of the fifth child. But there's also some other guidelines. For instance, if there's 4 to 5 years or more between children, like if there's a firstborn child and then 5 years later comes another child, then very often the roles will start over. It's like a new family has been created. I just worked with someone this morning who had an older sister who was a child of her mother but had a different father, and that child was a hero. And the child and the client that I saw was the second-born child of her mother's, but she was her dad's first-born child. And so she also had been a hero, and there was also like 8 years between she and her older sister, between her and her older sister. So, again, there are sort of special considerations to think about when we look at this model. But overall, it's a good guider. It's a good guide to begin to look at our own families with.
Why do you think these roles are assigned? Do you think that maybe because of children being very impressionable?
What I mean by assigned is that it's not that the parents decide this child's going to be the hero and that one's going to be our problem child. It's more that the system decides it. The system, as I said a minute ago, is like its own entity. And it has a set of needs and a set of rules that it operates by that doesn't take into consideration the needs of any individual in the family, including the parents. So the parents are just as stumped and surprised by this sort of birth order as anybody. It's sort of like, well, my first child turned out so good. What happened to my second? Why is the second one so bad? Well, it's because the system has a different need. So it's the needs of the family that determine the role that's assigned.
And would you say that emotional and physical needs in children are sometimes not met because they are in conflict with the needs of the system or the family unit?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the children's needs and every individual in the family, their needs are sacrificed for the, quote, good of the system. The system rules the family. Once a couple comes together and establishes a family, there is a whole set of rules that come into play that determine what needs get met, and the system rules will lord over the needs of any individual.
Why is it so important for children that a family unit helps them stabilize their lives?
Ask that again. I didn't quite hear that question, please.
Yeah, in your experience, why would you say that the family unit is kind of a need for children for stability, or it gives children stability?
Why would the family need to give the children stability? Is that what you're asking, or what now? Why would the system? I'm still confused about what you're asking. I'm sorry. I'm having a hard time hearing.
Okay. It's okay.
Yeah.
We're having problems with the Wi-Fi today. My question was the following. Why would you say that children need stability from the family unit?
Oh, okay. Why do the children need stability? Because every one of us, when we come into this earth plane, we arrive here needy. You know, think about an infant. When you hold an infant, they can't walk, they can't talk, they can't even feed themselves. They're totally dependent on getting their needs met by and through those around them. And so, but what happens, of course, is that we come into a family that's governed by imperfect humans. Every parent has comes from their own family system, had their own assigned role growing up, and so they come into and to start a new family very often from a place of unmet needs. So what happens is that depending on how well the needs of the particular child is met, and what are needs? Needs by the word, by the definition of the word need, means this. It has to happen. There are particular basic needs that we all have, not just food, air, shelter, water, but we also have emotional needs. We need to feel like that we belong. We need a sense of validity. We need to feel like that our thoughts and feelings are acceptable. We need to feel safe. There's a biggie. So there are basic human needs that every child, in order to thrive, in order to even survive, must have met. You know, years ago there was a research project done, and I'm talking, 60s probably, where they went into an orphanage and worked with children, and they had a group of children that they spent time with every day. They would hold the bottle when they fed the child and cuddle and talk to and yeah. love on those children. And then they had another group of children that were their basic fundamental needs were met. They were clothed and changed and fed, but they were not handled. They were not touched. Their bottles were prop fed. They were rather than held by human hand and rocked. And those children, every one of them, grew up or ended up with not only severe problems, but many of them did not even survive. So we know that there are critical emotional needs that all humans have.
Mm-hmm. So how would you define this responsibility of parents? Is it about protecting our children from experiencing pain?
You know, buffering our children from pain is not only not our job to a certain degree as parents, it's impossible. Just by virtue of being born on planet Earth carries with it life situations that we will have to experience. And as a matter of fact, it is going through life experiences, challenges, that we oftentimes develop our inner strength and find out what we're made of. So it's not so much that we're supposed to protect or try to buffer our children from pain. It is that as when a child is born, I like to say that for every year older a child gets, you know, their needs change, and we as parents are to take another step back from being responsible for them. In the beginning, we're totally responsible for them. Then as they're able to reach for things, we begin to step back and let them reach for what they can handle. We begin to let them assume more and more responsibility for themselves. That's our job. Our job as parents is to launch our children into a world where they are equipped to deal with. And if we totally buffer our children from experiencing life, they will not be equipped to deal with it.
So would you say childhood is a kind of initiation for little people on this earth?
Yes, I think that's a good way of saying it. I think that parents are our first initiators. And the sorts of things that we experience at their hands are, and how we deal with that has a lot to do with how we will handle life.
So what do you think children learn from this initiation?
Well, all sorts of things. One of the things we know, again, if we go back to some research that has been done, we know that many of our great philosophers, researchers, scientists, teachers, leaders of our world very often came through extreme dysfunction in their family. And it's sort of like this dysfunction we experience in our families will either make us or break us. It depends on what we do with that in our own minds. If we take on a sense of feeling at the mercy of, feeling victimized by, if the wounds we experience in life, if we see that as done to us, against us, at us, then we may not cope as well. The people who look at adversity in life and as children decide, well, I can handle this, you know, I'm going to make it through this, I'm going to be stronger as a result, I will show them that I can. When those are the people who grow up to not only do well in life, but oftentimes excel, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that our patience, our sense of tenacity, our resilience, comes from a starting point in development in our childhood?
I don't know that I would say that exactly. I think what I would say is that how resilient we are in life, how strong we are, how capable we are, has very much to do with what we decide about the things that we experience early in life.
I'm sorry, go on.
No, you go ahead.
Okay. Would you say then that there is a need for children to sense that adults are in charge?
What I said, I didn't understand what you asked. Again, please.
Yes. Would you say that children need to sense that adults are in charge?
Do children need to feel like adults are in charge as children? Yes, absolutely. It's very, like, we know that newborns like to be swaddled. They like to be wrapped tightly because it gives them a sense of security. And again, as that child grows, then containment is important to meet the need for safety. But we also, and for parents, it's a continuing, changing definition of what containment is needed, what containment is age appropriate for a particular child. The need and the kind of containment that a 5-year-old needs is very different than the amount of containment that a 12-year-old needs or a 16-year-old. The arena, I think of it as a yard with a fence around it. In the beginning, if a child is 3, 5, 6 years old, a yard with a fence around it is a good thing. It gives them a sense of security. They know where the boundaries are. They know that they're safe within the parameters of that place. The nose that a parent give our children serves that purpose. But then if you try to keep that child in that fence and they're 16 years old, then it becomes prison. It's no longer a sense of safety. It becomes something they need to break out of. And so for parents, it's always about finding that line between offering a sense of security through boundaries and being able to step back and give them more freedom and more space as they grow older and it's more appropriate to do so. Did that answer your question?
Yes, definitely. So what advice would you give parents, especially these parents who think or who feel that our children are extensions of ourselves?
Well, I would say to them, I would question that idea that my children are an extension of me. I think it is an erroneous notion. Our children come through us. They are not ours. They're not our possession. We are given the stewardship, if you want to use that word. We are given the privilege to steward them into becoming their own person. But if we decide that they are ours and that we get to, then we will try to control their life. And control has the opposite effect of being healthy. It actually often prompts our children to push us away and to try to get as far away from us as possible. Sooner or later, that happens.
And what advice would you give parents who feel guilty because their children are not responding to them or are not living in a way in which they would want them to?
You know, that there's so much I can say on that topic. I'm just trying to decide where would be the quickest, most helpful response. When our children, again, every child, every human being has their own life path, and it's not going to necessarily look like my path as their parent. My husband and I have 7 children together, and we have 3 grandchildren, and we're very active in their lives. And so, and our children are now, our youngest is 22, just turned 22, and our oldest is 42. So we've had a long range flow of children through our lives. We've learned a lot from them. And one of the most important things that I've learned from our children is that they don't belong to me, and that I don't get to decide, and that I may not like what they do. And for me, it's about always asking myself, what is my business here and what is not? I love what Byron Katie, author of Loving What Is, says about this topic. She says there are 3 kinds of business in the world. There's my business, there's your business, and there's God's business. And anytime I'm in your business or God's business, I and you are likely to be miserable. And I think this applies very much to our children, that our job as parents is to get clear on what is my business and what is their business. There is an old metaphysical principle that says by the age of 14, if you as a parent have not passed on to your children the ethics, the morals, the spiritual principles that you would wish for them to have, then it's too late. That doesn't mean they will never learn those things, but it's too late for you to push it off on them. In other words, at that age, they become their own moral person. They are responsible for their own ethics and their own principled choices by the age of 14. And so we begin to rapidly step back from feeling responsible for their life. I'm not responsible for their outcomes. It doesn't mean, it doesn't pain me to see some of the choices they make, but one thing I trust is that they, like myself, will learn great things from even the poor choices that they make. And that's the thing I count on. And I want to be there as a place of counsel, as a place of authentic, honest feedback for them. But if they feel that I'm trying to control their life, they will not turn to me for that. They will avoid me. If I want to still have a place in their life, then the best thing I can do is entrust them with their own life path and be really clear with that. So I don't tell them what to do. I share with them what my own experience, if they ask for it, especially as older children. I'll share, but I don't try to control their outcomes. It doesn't work.
So would you say that this guilt might also have something to do with an unresolved issue we are carrying inside, like maybe we were the hero, we were the scapegoat, or the lost child, or the mascot?
Yes, and you mean as parents?
Yes, as parents. And
yeah,
maybe we didn't heal that inner child, and now we're carrying with that. And maybe that's because, or that's the reason why we use this guilt language, like, you should do this or you should not do this or this is good,
yeah,
or this is bad.
Maybe
it has to do with our belief system.
Absolutely, Luciana. You know, I often tell my clients who are parents, the advice you're busy giving them is for you. You know, you take it. and
I like
think,
that.
Yeah, because I think that's very true, what you just said, that, yes, it is very often my own woundedness that I'm trying to fix through them, and it doesn't work. They're not me.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that's why we sometimes treat ourselves poorly, and then that's the way we treat others, including our children?
Yes, absolutely. If I grew up, and for me, in my family, I was the second born child. I was the scapegoat of my own family system. I was the one that very early, having heard it over and over again, decided that I was selfish and uncaring and the bad apple in the bunch. I remember being age 5 and thinking to myself, why do I have to be the rotten kid in this family? I really believed it. I believed in my badness. I believed that there was something just wrong and bad about me. And the thing about that is if we're walking around with that sort of wounded concept of ourselves, then we're going to feel and act as if it's true. And so when one believes they're bad, then they act the part in the world. I certainly did. I lived up to my own definition of myself, my own interpretation of the messages I was receiving from those around me. And so I was angry. One of the things I decided was that I was bad anyway, so it didn't much matter what I did. It was hopeless. I was hopeless. No one was going to love me. I was unlovable because I was so bad. And so this was my thinking. And so I was angry. It was sort of like anger became my protection. If I was angry with you, then I would sort of reject you before you had a chance to reject me. And so I would strike out from that hurt place in anger and pushing others away. And so of course, then I had children. My first child was born at the age of 16. I was 16 years old and caught up in the whole badness of who I was. Well, that child had a job. His job was he was somehow going to save me from feeling so bad. That was his job. And, of course, he was a hero right off the bat. He had to be the one who saved his mama. Can you imagine being a little infant and feeling the emotional pressure of having to fix someone who was so wounded? And this is just to give you an idea of how family systems get passed down from generation to generation.
Yeah, what you're saying rings a little loud to me as well. How would you go from there? How did you manage to go from there, from feeling helpless or from feeling misunderstood, to actually take charge of your life, actually assuming what was your responsibility in each case, and then going from there towards peace of mind, towards feeling, leading a life in peace?
You know, it's been a long road, and now at this point in my life, at almost 60 years old, I look back and I see every stage of it is necessary. So there's nothing about what happened in my life that I think to myself should not have happened. I think it was all part of my journey and uniquely prepared me to be sitting here on the phone with you right now and to be working with the clients that I do. The turnaround point, probably there were several sort of epiphanies that happened for me along the way, and some of them were painful. I got into drugs and alcohol and lived a path of addiction for a while, and when I bottomed out there and found my way into treatment, that was a huge turnaround. That was a shifting point when I began to take responsibility for myself. I think that was the first and the most necessary thing that has to happen in order to turn our lives around, that we begin to take responsibility and stop seeing the world as doing it to me, stop seeing ourselves as victims of the world and of others and begin to understand that, no, it's not what happened to me, but it's what I decided about myself in relation to the things that happen that determine the quality of my life. And when I began to see that I could read aside how I saw my childhood, then things began to change dramatically and very rapidly for the better.
Would you say that at some points in our life, it is helpful to review our belief systems in order to understand what our life is about, and that way reaching or remembering about our own sense of peace?
Yes, I think it's critical, and the sooner the better. You know, there's a formula that applies here, and it says that when I think a thought and believe it, I am automatically, as soon as I believe what I think, two things happen. One is I begin to feel as if it's true, and the second thing is I begin to act as if it's true. And when I feel and act as if what I'm believing is true, then I will react to the world from that place, and I will react in a way that will invite the world to give me the evidence that proves that what I believe is true. And this is the way we go through life, proving over and over that our limited, painful thoughts and beliefs are true. We do that. And so we do, whenever, yeah, it does call for examining, what do I believe? I keep harvesting this particular harvest in my life. Maybe there's themes that each of us have that runs through our life, and it's the woundedness from our childhood that keeps replaying. It's sort of another thing that I often tell clients is that if you want to know what happened in your life back then as a child, then take a look at what's going on in your life today, because it will be a reenactment of that childhood theme. If it was a theme of rejection, then over and over again, in all situations, perhaps, you will find yourself feeling that same old rejection, abandonment. If it was a theme of never being able to be good enough, then over and over again we will find ourselves with people and in situations where the message to us is that we're not good enough, that we didn't do it right enough, that we can't do it well. So we have these themes, and they are all based in decisions we made and thereby beliefs that came out of those decisions way back then, often before the age of 5. By the age of 5, we have a belief system intact that will govern the way, the outcomes, the quality of our life from then forward until or unless we stop and begin to make conscious our belief system and question it.
Mm-hmm. So in your experience, from a victimhood state,
okay, I just lost you. You're going to have to say, I can't hear you now. Can you say again? Oops, I lost you.
Sure. So in your experience, it is possible to go from a victim state to a hero state.
Oh, absolutely. And it can happen very quickly through questioning my beliefs. But that is the critical thing. I have to look inward. I call it, there's two orientations that we have in life. We either are externally oriented, we're externally focused, and when we're externally focused, we are busy feeling at the mercy of what's happening outside of us. We think that the reason we feel bad is because of something someone out there did or said. It's because he won't let me, or she kept me from, or she said this or that to me. That's an external orientation. But in order to really make the shift, we must move from that external orientation and begin to look inward to what I call the internal orientation. And the internal orientation is one where, instead of seeing ourselves at the mercy of external causes, instead of seeing things out there as being the reason we feel the way we do, we understand that the world is simply mirroring to us our own beliefs. And we use what happens in the world as a way to find what we are believing internally that sets us up for that reoccurring theme, for instance, over and over again. We find the culprit in our own mind, and we question it there so that we can liberate ourselves from having to feel and act as if it's true. Because as soon as we move into what I call observer consciousness, we're able to stand back and question, and as soon as we ask ourselves the first question can be, what am I believing that's prompting me to react in that way? What am I believing that's creating this theme of rejection in my life? And we look for the belief, and then we ask ourselves, and maybe the belief is that I'm unlovable. So if there's a core belief that says I'm unlovable, as long as I believe that, remember, I'm going to feel as if it's true. I'm going to act as if it's true. And thereby I will be acting in ways that are unlovable. And what will that elicit from others? It will elicit their response will be, which proves to me I'm right.
So what last suggestion would you give our listeners on how to make inner peace with our inner child, how to reparent our inner child in order to be able to live in peace?
It would be about looking for what the belief theme is in your life and beginning to question that. And there's two sources I would refer listeners to, and one is my own book, which is Guiding Principles for Life Beyond Victim Consciousness. You can buy it at Amazon.com. which is a step-by-step process of moving out of victim consciousness. And the other work that I would recommend that I quote in my book, and often I believe that she has done a beautiful job of helping tap into observer consciousness, is Byron Katie's work, Loving What Is. She has a webpage, thework.com. Those are two suggestions. If you're serious about wanting to turn your life around, get involved in a process of beginning to take responsibility for your own beliefs and the woundedness. Remembering the woundedness is not so much what wounds us today is not so much what happened to us back then, but what it is we decided what happened to us means about us. That's what goes on damaging us. And so it's at that level we began to intervene.
For all our listeners, if you want to buy Lynn's book, you just have to click on the name of the book, which is featured on our Blog Talk radio page, innerhealers.com, and you'll be able to buy it instantly. I want to thank you, Lynn, for all that you've shared with us today. Thank you again for sharing your light with us. And sorry, my apologies for the Wi-Fi connection problem.
Well, thanks. Thank you so much, Luciana. And thank you for being patient with me as I stumbled through trying to hear properly. And thank you for listening. Thanks for reaching out to me. And thank you,
Luciana. You're beautiful. Thank you for being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
A big hug your way. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.